Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Wednesday, May 1st, Joe was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and director, actor, educator, and co-founder of Wham Theater, Kristen Van Genhoven.
Exactly 56 years to the day after the 1968 student occupation at Columbia University was violently cleared by New York Police Department, hundreds of police officers moved into the Manhattan campus on Tuesday night to quell a different kind of anti-war protest. Dozens of pro-Palestinian demonstrators were arrested as police officers entered Columbia's main campus, which was on lockdown, and cleared Hamilton Hall. They cleared it of a group who had broken in and occupied it the night before. There was a tent encampment right in the center of the university. This is, if you are going down 114th Street toward Broadway, you have the Butler Library right to your right-hand side. And if you walked through the Butler Library, you then would be in the tent encampment. If you look off to your right in the College Square, you would see Hamilton Hall, which was occupied by protesters. If you continued that and walked over to Amsterdam Avenue, which runs parallel to 114—runs parallel to Broadway— you would see that is where police first entered through an upper floor last night and made the arrests that they did. It was dizzying and, to many students and faculty, deeply, deeply disturbing. Last time students were protesting the Vietnam War and Columbia's plans to expand its campus into Harlem. This time students were protesting the Israeli offensive in Gaza that has killed about 34,000 people, according to health officials there, and trying to force the university to divest from companies with ties to Israel. On Monday, the protest entered more peaceably and than the one in 1968, but the students' tactics were the same. By escalating their protest to the point where the university was unable to function, students forced the hand of administrators who brought in the police to arrest them. Both times, the students had occupied Hamilton Hall. The dozens of arrests on Tuesday were the culmination of 2 weeks of intense turmoil on Columbia's campus. Tensions over pro-Palestinian demonstrations were already high when the Columbia University president went to Washington to testify before a congressional committee on April 17th about anti-Semitism on campus. Then, while she was in Washington, a group of pro-Palestinian demonstrators set up a large tent encampment in front of Butler Library. And again, a Butler Library is the building that you would enter from 114th Street. At this time, the group said that this Gaza Solidarity Encampment declared it a liberated zone, directly quoting from the 1968 protests. The president of the university, still in Washington, declared in a letter to the police the next day that those protests were a clear and present danger to the substantial functioning of the university, though by all accounts the encampment had been nonviolent. As hundreds of students and other onlookers watched and rallied in support of the encampment, rows of police officers in riot gear entered campus just after one. At least 108 students were arrested. But some of the hundreds of supporters who remained simply moved to the next lawn and started a new encampment. And then nearly 2 weeks later, on Monday, a faction of the protesters decided to escalate things even further after a breakdown in negotiations with Columbia. And as the university began to suspend students who had not cleared the encampment by an afternoon deadline, there were expulsions from the university as well. That night, the student protesters from the encampment, fortified by hundreds of other pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had arrived late that evening, divided into groups. One group went to Hamilton Hall. That is where Police entered yesterday, last night, through a series officers in riot gear, although I would say not full riot gear, and were going into the building to make the arrests on Tuesday night. That is the setup. Let's start with Nick Rangel.
Well, you know, that is one setup. I don't know that that is the full setup. I think missing from that, you know, otherwise very descriptive introduction were some really key facts in the particular scenario yesterday. It should be noted, for example, that as far as I've found, there's not been allegations that the student protesters were engaging in violence before the police were called in. Dozens of faculty and staff of the university had actually linked arms and put themselves between the students and law enforcement in order to protect the students from the police. And I think that that is a really crucial piece of information because it's clear that, one, what the students are doing is not controversial to everybody, and two, that there are a lot of people on campus who do support the students' right to protest and their free speech. I think it's important to note that the escalation happened after Columbia administration decided to cut off negotiations with the students. And I think there's this really interesting conversation going on that we have students, faculty and staff, union members who are protesting on the basis of two key policy elements. One, that the school divest from institutions that are profiting from the war in Gaza, and two, that the school call for a ceasefire. And what's interesting is that lots of people are calling for those two exact policy positions. The majority of Democrats, certainly. I know that I do believe that a large group of Americans do think there should be a ceasefire. I know the president has called for a ceasefire. I know that the UN has called for a ceasefire. These are not controversial policy positions to be taking, and yet they're being met with actual state violence. And that is a really important conversation to have about what is going on these campuses across the country.
Let me ask you, during the coverage last night, over and over and over again on the cable networks, the people who had any background in law enforcement were saying that this was a clear violation, that we're not, I heard this more than five times where people would say, look, this is not a matter of cutting out free speech. This is a matter of safety. This is a matter of keeping the campus clear. And for those students who are getting ready for final exams, for those students who are getting ready for graduation, that this situation needs to be taken care of. The thing that struck me, Nick, about what you just said and about even what I just said is that the number of arrests relatively low, given the presence that was there yesterday, and I just wonder, so I agree with you. I'm wondering what could have been done in another way to achieve what they wanted to achieve, and I guess that gets back to the discussions that broke down with administrators, but it seems like the administrators did have options that they chose not to use.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. Protests by nature, if they are effective, are a violation of something.
They're disruptive.
That's the whole point. Yeah. That is what a demonstration is. Otherwise, you're kind of just having a picnic in the park. They are supposed to be disruptive, right? And you know, not all demonstrations are disruptive, but demonstrations that are disruptive, the disruption is the point. It is to bring attention and to force the conversation where other means of effort have gone unanswered, right? So the students had been trying to have this conversation with the administration, and this war has been going on for many, many months. This isn't a new, you know, this is a conversation that's been going on, and that's not a new movement either. Divesting college funds from particular industries is as old as investments, right? And campus investments. Yeah. So the idea that, well, police came in because there were violations, it just sort of ignores the fact that there was still a choice to be made. Our own campuses locally have had very successful, I would call them very successful demonstrations, where there was neither violence nor police violence or police engagement. And you know what happens at the end of the night when there's no engagement and things just are allowed to be said and the speakers are allowed to speak and the teach-ins are allowed to happen and the encampment is put up, is that everyone just goes home. They just go home. And the map that we're seeing of the school protests, they're only showing the protests where police have been engaged and have used arrest and detentions and suspensions of campus, and even I think some students are being permanently terminated, right?
Right. It's being expelled.
Those are the only schools on the map. They're not showing the hundreds of other schools that have allowed protest and conversation and discourse to happen and have preserved the right of students to exercise their freedom of speech.
I just do want to be fair. I believe the expulsions, I think there were two, and I could be wrong on that. But both
UCLA, I think, is expelling lots of people.
I'm just calling about Columbia. I apologize. Yeah. But in the Columbia example, the people who were expelled, the reason for the expulsion was death threats.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's
there
just,
are outliers.
Yes.
What we're not talking about is, are all the faculty and staff who have been involved being fired? I think that'd be an interesting question, right? I mean, there's so much that we're not talking about. Just full disclosure, I do run the local National Lawyers Guild chapter. It's a national bar association, and one of our primary objectives is to provide support, legal support, to people who are engaging in progressive movements via protests and demonstrations. And so this is an issue that that a group of volunteers locally and nationwide are deeply embedded in, because, you know, in order to preserve somebody's rights, there needs to be somebody there who can observe what is happening and be a witness, right? Be a witness to the protest and the engagement by law enforcement. And, you know, the impact there, or the convergence of legal support, is this argument that there was a violation, and the violation is what is underlying the arrest itself.
We now go to Vera Carias-Kelly.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about what universities can do to prevent, you know, the kind of more explosive interactions between police and administrations that don't really engage with the students. And we have a number of campuses where negotiations were very effective with the students, where administrators, college presidents, staff and faculty actually walked around, spoke with the students in their encampments. And the most prominent examples, of course, we have are Yale and Brown. And they have, both campuses have the potential to be just as explosive as Columbia, but they used a different strategy in terms of the administration. They recognized this was a moment of learning and experiencing diversity in opinions and positions. And they fully engaged with the students. They asked teams of student leaders to meet with the administration to talk about issues such as divestment, which is, you know, in years past, divestment was considered, I mean, in the South African case, it was used by students as a pressure point to push for the anti-apartment policies that eventually were implemented. But in recent years, the divestment efforts, in terms of not investing in weapons manufacturing and weapons that are then sold to Israel, has been labeled as anti-Semitic. And in that sense, it was a very interesting conversation to see happen on campuses because, in fact, administrators began to discuss options for divestment. And students might think divestment is an easy one, quick decision or signature, when in fact it is a long process because universities such as Brown and Yale have enormous amounts of money invested in the market. And it is managers of these funds that actually allocate where the money goes. So it is not simply the idea that an administrator signs something and then you divest. But what's interesting about the process that has happened at these colleges is students get an education in so many different ways. First of all, they learn about how administrations think and work, how college presidents are being pressured by political appointees in their states, how they're dependent on fundraising in the environment of colleges, not necessarily Brown and Yale, but many colleges. So students begin to learn how a corporation, in essence, such as a university, even though they might be nonprofit, they are large corporations and they invest. And so this conversation that they're having at other universities, it's about what is free speech? What are the interests of the institution? What are the interests of students? And how can we come together to find a path forward that resolves and addresses your legitimate concerns of how our money might actually help in the bombardment of civilians, women and children in Gaza? How do we play a role in that, and how can we have a conversation about that to change that? And as soon as the students felt like they were being listened to and heard, and they could learn along the way, and now they have a months-long process of meeting, discussing, figuring out a vote, and making a change. And that will lead to a successful outcome. And why that cannot be done at places like Columbia? Well, maybe it is because of the leadership they have that didn't interact with the students in the very beginning, called in the police, dealt with a lot of politicians that came on campuses and added to the pressure. It is New York City. It is sort of being reported on consistently. It's high media attention. So there are a number of factors that might be different in New York City or UCLA. But in fact, we have counterexamples of how we can make this kind of a protest lead to an educational outcome and to a more open discussion about what anti-Semitism is, what might be looking like criticism of Israeli policies, of the government there, how we need to address the fact that we have ongoing negotiations for an attempt at a ceasefire again today. Hopefully we'll hear something. The fact that we have U.S. citizens still as hostages, and of course many other hostages held by Hamas that we don't know if they're alive or dead. I mean, there's so many conversations we need to have about what is just, what should our policies look like, and it's not just one policy; it's a series of policies, and that is what is beginning on some campuses, but not others, where the administrations relied almost exclusively on police intervention.
Yeah. Kristen.
Yeah, I think that what I can add to this already very robust conversation is just to affirm that, like, having the information and the knowledge, like Nick was talking about the, you know, what are the choices that all parties involved have in these situations? What is the historical context of protest? What are the legal ramifications of certain choices? What are the ways that this quote unquote usually goes in terms of freedom of speech and creating a protest? And then also having the history of knowing that this has been a form of protest for students for many years. I mean, I think I saw last night 155 universities in 1978, and, you know, divesting from companies doing business with apartheid in South Africa, right? Over a million students across 880 campuses participated in the campus walkouts to protest the Vietnam War in 1970. These are the examples that the students today are using as inspiration and motivation and to do what they're doing. What I can add is that we can't forget the context of not just the past 4 years, that these students are the COVID university students, these students are the racial reckoning students, what they have been having as their pressure cooker over the past 4 years has really been influencing, I think, the nature of this particular protest and how it fits into the larger historical context of these types of student protests across generations. And knowing that every university has set a foundation in a very different way. So you have some universities who perhaps over the past 10 years, 5 years, have established, have set the table in a certain way that encourages transparent communication, co-learning moments, peer-to-peer learning between administration, faculty, and students. And they're trying to figure out this unprecedented time together. And some universities have been able to do that, maybe because of leadership, maybe because of location, maybe because of just who happens to be student leadership at that time. And other universities may have had less success in doing that for all of those same reasons. So there's so much nuance around which universities will have successfully been able to create an atmosphere of joint mediation and which universities are not going to do that. And this is another example of how important it is to have those really strong mediators at all levels of it and to take advantage of faculty that are coming forward to offer to be mediators, mm-hmm. of community leaders who are offering to come and do that, politicians who are offering to come and do that. We also talked about how university leadership is in a really tough spot. They've got Congress on one side breathing down their neck about different things. They've got the students on the other side saying they're not moving quick enough to change policies and procedures. It's a very difficult spot to expect every single university leader to know exactly what to do in these unprecedented situations. And these things happen very quickly. It's not like they have time, although in one sense they have had a lot of time. They've had a lot of time over the past 5 years to gather the skills around how to have conflict across difference, to how to figure out how this is not an oppression Olympics. You have your students who are Muslim who since 9/11, since all decades have been experiencing oppression. The same with your Jewish students, the same with any other of your students that have been historically marginalized, or as I heard the other day from a fantastic cultural competency trainer, Ashante, that I work with, called Underestimated Communities. And figuring out how to have those conversations is what is really important to move this forward. That's why it's astonishing when you see all of the efforts across the country to ban cultural competency, anti-racism, DEI, whichever words you want to use around that training that allows us to see all of the different perspectives that are in the world that we live in.
Kristen Van Genhoven on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, May 1st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel of the Week in Review after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Thursday, May 2nd, Joe Donahue was joined for the Roundtable Panel discussion by Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Yesterday, we were discussing the implementation of the 6-week abortion ban in Florida, which took effect yesterday, and it will be on the ballot in November. However, it still is very much an issue and something that that is of grave concern for those who consider themselves to be pro-choice. And the biggest, and we talked about this at length yesterday, so I don't want to get into it entirely, but when you look at the maps, and the New York Times has an incredible graphic that shows if you live in Texas, if you live, but especially in Florida, anywhere in Florida, you're looking at almost a 400-mile drive if you are going to look for abortion or women's health services. So that is insane, of course, at least I believe it is. And so then we go to a slightly better story, which is Arizona. Now, Arizona's court came out and said, you know what? Let's go with the law from 1864. That seems to be about where we want to put our thoughts on women's rights. So then the Republicans in the Arizona Senate said, well, no, we're gonna support the court and we're gonna continue to do this. Meanwhile, the Arizona Senate tried again, and they were able to find, Profiles in Courage, they were able to find two Republicans who would vote with them, and that they indeed were able to repeal the law, the 1864 abortion ban. Now it's on the governor's plate to sign, but because of procedural hurdles, it remains on track to temporarily take effect in June, and they're working that out as we speak. Judy.
Yeah, so that will work it out until June, and we don't want that gap to be there, because there are going to be real women really affected by this. I wanted to raise the point about having to travel 400 miles, which may not be a real issue for a woman of means. Like, yeah, if you take a couple days off from work, you got this paid time off, you can do this. But so many women can't afford to go 400 miles. They can't afford the bus ticket. They can't afford to take the day off from work. They can't find someone to watch their other children. I think it's the women, it's women who do not have the financial wherewithal to go across the country.
And not just for one appointment, but for several. 1, 2, 3 appointments.
Exactly. And, you know, even when abortion was outlawed in this country, women who had money could travel to Europe and get abortions. So that's been there. What we're talking about is equal access for millions of women. It's what's happening in this country. Even if Arizona wants to revert to the 15-week abortion ban, which is still a tough rule to abide by. It doesn't recognize that really women should have the right to make these decisions by themselves.
Well, I think for me, it's highlighting that women in this country do not have equal rights. If you need any example of what we mean when we say we need an equal rights amendment for women, this is it. Women now, their health depends on where they live in this country. And if that does not send a message that we are second-class citizens, that we do not have the same rights to health care as men, I don't know what kind of wake-up call people need. And that is where, for me, what is being sent out to the world is that this incredible experiment of the United States of America that's admired in countries around the world, including Switzerland, where I just was, that maybe this isn't a place where they want to come, because this highlights that we can go state by state to determine how women are going to be treated with respect to access to health care. And that's what we're talking about. We are talking about healthcare. And if we had a rule in this country where men could get vasectomies in certain states and not in other states, we wouldn't be having that conversation. It would be absurd. But for women, it's not absurd. And that message is now being sent to our daughters and our granddaughters. That is what this is about. We do not have equal rights because we do not have access to health care equally across this country. And that's a frightening, it's a frightening thing for me as a woman, because then you think, well, what else? What other rights could be different for me if I were to go to Texas or Florida or Arizona than the rights that I enjoy here in New York State?
And it seems, I so agree with everything you just said, and it seems to me that the next thing on the horizon, if they work this out, then the next thing will be contraception. And then the next thing is God knows what that will have an effect on women and the family. It's very sobering. And meanwhile, I'm a baseball guy. I love watching baseball games. I'm a Philadelphia Phillies fan. I watch the games every night. If I see one more of those ads with those little hymns, those little pills that you go in that are the Viagra or the Cialis, that all you have to do is basically call up and give them $8. And yet, men, it's not an issue. For their health care, they can just call up a toll-free number and be taken care of. And meanwhile, there are women who are trying to deal with their health care and with their issues and are having to travel 200-400 miles, which just seems mind-blowing. Mark Whitman.
Just a couple thoughts, Joe. One thing I'd mention is that if the BBC is right, that the law that's going to rule once we finally get to the 2022 law in Arizona does not provide an exception for rape or incest in Arizona. So that's obviously problematic. I went to college in San Antonio, Texas, and we used to have to travel, I think it was 6 hours at a minimum, to get to a state other than Mexico. So imagine for women or young women now what that entails. And you can't go to Oklahoma. You have to go to, I think it's New Mexico is the nearest state that permits it. And my wife and I were talking about sending my son to college there someday. And my wife said, well, obviously, if he was a young woman, we wouldn't want to send him there. And even as a young man, to send him to a state that basically is so degrading women and their health needs is something that we probably would suggest against it when he was making a decision that's not the kind of culture in which you want to continue to cultivate your understanding of the world. It's obviously a sad state of affairs. And all of this goes to the absurdity of the Dobbs decision, where Alito said that there was no legal reliance in this world, in this country, on the Roe versus Wade decision. They kind of said, yeah, we can change this law and it's not going to disrupt American life. And they've been proven so painfully wrong, as so many of us knew on that day when they announced the decision.
We are talking about the Arizona Senate voting to repeal the 1864 abortion ban, talking about what it means and what is next, and also still talking about the remnants of the conversation from yesterday in regards to the 6-week abortion ban that went into effect this week in the state of Florida. Did anyone else want to add anything to the conversation?
Well, you know, it's interesting that this whole scenario has made people in Arizona grateful for a 15-week ban, which is still a barrier to free access to health care for women. And that will likely be the Republican position going forward. So we're happy with 15 weeks when we have to remember that before Dobbs, we had more than 15 weeks.
It's also, and I just think it doesn't hurt to remind people that when the announcement was made about the court's decision in Arizona was 24 hours after the presumptive candidate on the Republican side, former President Donald Trump, looked to, quote unquote, set the record straight on his views on abortion and saying that we absolutely have to allow it to go to the states, because that is where it will make the most sense. And then 24 hours later, this decision comes out, and it's a stark reminder of exactly what happens in that regard.
Yeah, and he and Carrie Lake had to backpedal very quickly. A couple things. Number one, 96% of abortions in the United States take place in the first trimester. So if you're looking for the big win, the 15 weeks, don't get me wrong, it's not the right answer, but it's the answer that covers most of what you see. Politically, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. As I've said before, it's interesting to note that since Dobbs, no incumbent senator or governor has, Republican governor, have lost their seat. So it'll, and if you look at the polls, the saliency of abortion for voters as a whole is behind the economy, the border, and probably one or two other issues. But if you've got a specific referendum that's getting people out to the polls, it'll be interesting to see how that changes the dynamics. And I think the Republicans are worried about that, and I think the Democrats are rightfully optimistic, but we'll see how it all shakes out.
You know, I think about, I've been thinking about that with the referendums, because I recall back when it was George Bush was up for re-election, George Bush II, and there were referendums around same-sex marriage on some of the ballots, which people felt swung things in favor of the Republicans. I mean, it's hard to believe, but it wasn't that long ago when that was incredibly controversial. And so having these ballot measures with respect to abortion, where the numbers are so overwhelmingly in favor of abortion access, I think if I were Republicans, I'd be nervous about them, too, because I do think that it's going to bring out younger voters, especially young women, who are in percentage terms even more overwhelmingly in favor of access to abortion services and reproductive health care.
We go to this letter from Anne, who directs this to Mayor Sheehan. Why is the targeting of one segment of our population even legal?
Well, again, we don't have equal rights in the Constitution, and that is why women are fighting for an Equal Rights Amendment and reviving the Equal Rights Amendment, so that we can make it clear that we have equal rights to men in our Constitution.
We go to this letter from, I believe, let's just say from a listener, because I can't make out the name. Pete, I believe. Question for the panel. If state law is driving women's health care to occur over state lines, can the federal government do something under the Interstate Commerce Clause in the U.S. Constitution?
I mean, you know, it would be an interesting thing for somebody to raise as an issue, but I don't think so. I mean, I think that...
And it would go to the Supreme Court.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, look, you know, the Dobbs decision said that women of reproductive age do not have a right to privacy. That's really what it says. And so as long as that is the law of the land in the U.S. Supreme Court, it allows states to make regulations with respect to their reproductive freedoms. And that has been now reverted back to the states. And, you know, the chaos, as was pointed out, has begun.
Right. This has come up a little bit when we discuss mailing of pills that cause an abortion to happen across state lines, and whether or not the issuing entity in the state that does allow this would somehow be civilly or criminally liable if they ship to a state which outlaws abortion. So those are states on both sides of this issue are trying to devise laws to protect their position on this one.
Go back to the letters. Bob writes, abortion restriction of 15 weeks is the norm for most of liberal Europe. That from Bob.
Yeah, Bob, the one thing I would add to that, and it's not a correction, but there is a 15-week limit in Europe, but there are exceptions, and it's been told to me that in many countries, the de facto practice is even after 15 weeks, once that exam room door closes, the decision is pretty much up to a woman and those she shares the decision with, including her healthcare provider.
Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on May 2nd. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, May 3rd, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti.
Yesterday, during the program, for a great deal of the program, we were talking about the student protests that have been taking place and are taking place across these United States of America. We focused surely on Columbia, at least 2 days ago we did. Yesterday we were focusing on UCLA as well as Fordham University, but many, many universities are seeing arrests and more encampments and so forth. So we have been talking about that. One of the themes that came out of our conversation yesterday was about the opportunity and the problems that this means for Joe Biden, and what are the inherent issues here. And we have been hearing from Republicans that here is a president who has not even addressed this issue, had not talked about it at all. About 8 minutes after we got off the air yesterday, and I'm not even exaggerating on the time, but 8 minutes after we got off the air, the president walked in and said, I have some comments to make regarding what is happening on college campuses. It was unscheduled, and it was not something that we were immediately expecting, although we did run it here during the program. After a night of tumultuous pro-Palestinian protests and sizable arrests at prominent campuses on the East and West Coasts, President Biden on Thursday forcefully urged demonstrators to remain peaceful in his first extensive statements on the unrest that has swept universities nationwide. One of the things that came out of our conversations yesterday was, okay, what is he going to say? What meaningful things can he say? So here are the things that he did say, and then it will be our job to find out if that is indeed meaningful. Biden decried the tactics and violence seen on some campuses while supporting the rights of students to make their voices heard. "We've all seen the images," Biden said. "Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law." The unscheduled remarks were Biden's most comprehensive yet on the 2 weeks of contagious pro-Palestinian demonstrations disrupting college life in many parts of the country. They come as former President Donald Trump and other Republicans seize on the escalating clashes to depict the U.S. as out of control. "These are radical left lunatics," Trump told reporters on Thursday. "They got to be stopped now because it's going to go on and on and on, and it's going to get worse and worse." Aaron.
Yeah. Obviously, Biden calling for the protesters to remain peaceful is pretty basic and not really saying all that much. But, you know, in a time of very heightened tension and, unease about the U.S. position with Israel and Palestine, that seems to be what a president should do, is being taking a leadership role, you know, encouraging these protesters to exercise their First Amendment rights, but do so in a peaceful manner, you know, primarily not to feed into the, you know, the whole Trump American carnage, the country's out of control idea. But from the protesters' perspective, you know, obviously a lot of them are pro-Palestinian, in favor of a ceasefire, and they're using their leverage as Biden supporters to try to essentially tilt the dial, because it's going to be a close election, and, you know, Biden can't afford to lose, you know, these younger voters who clearly, I mean, they don't want Trump, but they also are trying to use their, you know, position as a voting bloc to kind of tilt the scales in terms of U.S. policy. And, you know, sometimes just being peaceful doesn't necessarily accomplish that because it doesn't grab the headlines and, you know, get people's blood pressure up. So I think Biden did the right thing by calling for it to be peaceful. Obviously, he's not going to call for them to escalate. He's not going to call for them to disperse. So the announcement was, you know, I don't know, pretty standard and pretty boring. And I don't think he said much, and I don't think it will have much of an impact.
Fred?
Yeah, I think the first point to make on this is that the president of the United States has very little control, objectively speaking, over this situation. There are Republicans calling on him to federalize the National Guard in some states and send in the National Guard. I mean, this is absurd. There are people calling on the president to denounce the demonstrators. That would seem to lead nowhere as well. On some campuses, there is an objective problem in that non-students are beginning to play a role. The other day, there were, 112 people arrested at Columbia. This right. was on Tuesday, I believe. 29% had no affiliation with the university. The other day, there were 170 students arrested at City College. Fully 60% had no connection to City College. The other day in class, I teach a class this semester at Bard called Power, Diplomacy, and Warfare. And I devoted a big part of the class just
sounds
to,
like an easy credit.
Yeah, it's an easy A. I devoted a big part of the class to listening to my 18 students to get their views on what was going on. Bard has been basically calm. We have an active chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, but it's been calm. The president of the school has made plenty of time to speak with students. What I heard from my students who have friends at the various places, UCLA and Columbia, where there have been major demonstrations. You know, what I hear is that there is the student perception is that there is a basic lack of leadership in the administrations of these schools, that there is very little outreach to students, very little dialogue with students. Students feel that when there is a discussion, they're not being treated with respect by college administrators. And this goes to the basic issue of leadership 101, okay? And I wonder how people can rise to be president of a university, chancellor of a university, without having a solid background in leadership, not just management of resources, but leadership of people. And this seems to be lacking. And this seems to be the common denominator in places where things have gone a bit out of control.
I thought the Biden remarks were calm, clear, and complete. What worries me in all of this is I fear that the Republicans are clearly using this as a wedge issue to try to divide and to try to weaken the Democrats. And I think that's abhorrent. But the underlying issue is what's happening to the people in Gaza. And that's what should be being discussed. And what are we going to, you know, there are children there who are still literally starving to death with trucks filled with food that are not allowed in. I was talking with a friend of mine who follows this, who's an expert in emergency response, and he was saying that pre-October 7th, about 500 trucks came in a day. And that was before all the buildings were destroyed, all the water infrastructure destroyed, all the medical infrastructure destroyed. Now there are only a trickle of trucks coming in per day. And that there is, you know, little to no portable water. You have 35,000 people dead, and you have 0 hours of electricity, right? It's a almost uninhabitable situation, and you still have the issue of, will the Israelis start bombing in Rafah, which is the only safe place where people are, such it is safe. And often living in tents without food, without water, without medical care.
Yeah, the bombing in Rafah has actually started on a fairly low scale. The number of trucks getting into Gaza has increased over the past week or 10 days, largely because of the insistence
President
Biden directly to Prime Minister Netanyahu. You know, I don't know how much the Republican Party will really be able to capitalize on this issue in a partisan political sense. Recent polls indicate that for young Americans, young American voters, which is defined by the polls as people between the ages of 20 and 29, this issue ranks very low in their priorities. I must say, surprisingly low, but as somebody steeped in the Middle East, that would be my reaction. You mean not everybody's interested in this? No. They're more interested in, the economy, inflation, all these, our southern border, all of these things. This issue ranks very low. And the other thing is a practical matter, and it's something I'm very interested in and really can't wait for. The end of the semester is looming, and students at that point will have a choice. Do I hang around and continue to camp on campus, or do I go home to my summer job, my internship, whatever it is I'm going to do. So I agree with you entirely. The situation in Gaza is desperate. It's certainly worthy of protest, but I think there are, as a practical matter, sharp limitations to the ability of President Biden's opponents to really capitalize politically on this.
I think you make such an interesting point about the semester, because we're gonna, just by the clock, when you and by the month, as you turn the page of this week to next week, and as commencements start, this is obviously going to dissipate. We did talk on the panel yesterday. We did talk on the panel yesterday about the other concerns, which of course are, wherever President Biden is going to speak, there is going to be some sort of interruption. And as Mark Whitman put it, and I think rightfully so, and the biggest concern being what happens at the Democratic National Convention as a result of this. I think, yes, the student protests we may be done with for the summer, although many protests to continue throughout other venues.
Yeah, and in that connection, later on this month, the president is supposed to speak at the commencement exercise at Morehouse College. And there was just a statement published that says, quote, "Any college or university that gives its stage to President Biden in this moment is endorsing genocide." Unquote. This was published by a group of Morehouse College professors in an unsigned public letter. And I want to emphasize that, an unsigned public letter. What kind of people are these who we entrust the education of our young people to, who cannot even put their names to something like this? I can understand why they want to be anonymous, but it's gutless nonetheless.
And that brings us back to what you said earlier, which I think is important about leadership and about the presence of the universities, but I think that goes for everyone, is the importance of dialogue and the importance of real dialogue, real listening to all sides, and what the reaction might be. And I think that the presidents of the universities need to understand that, right? And the real leaders you see in the universities where it's calmer, I think you're going to find that those are universities where the president and others have been talking with the students, creating forums in which they can be educated, listen, learn about all sides of the issue. And again, in a conversation with a friend of mine who's expert on this, we were talking about, I think tomorrow is the anniversary of Kent State. Right, of the National Guard going into Kent State. And after that, he was reminding me, and I knew this and forgot, but a few nights later, President Nixon woke up during the night. There were protesters at the Lincoln Memorial, and he asked to be driven there. And he went, and he just spent several hours listening and talking to the protesters, mm-hmm. quietly, without media, and listening back and forth. And I think that... that's the kind of it's that kind of broad dialogue, not the shouting that I think the Republicans are doing right now, but the real listening, learning, hearing from all sides is what we need more of here to lower the temperature and expand the knowledge and understanding.
I think there's an asymmetry that I think you're pointing out, and that is Republicans are interested in using this as political capital to, you know, rally the base and to get them worked up about, you know, Biden losing control on America or whatever. They're not interested in dialogue. They're not interested in hearing what the opposing sides have to say. I don't think they particularly care one way or the other. So you would think that the Democrats, in terms of just, you know, Biden's attempt to say, you know, keep it peaceful, you could make arguments that, you know, they're not particularly interested in dialogue as well with the protesters. But I don't think that they're using this cheaply in terms of political capital the way Trump is. I also think that Trump's probably just a little miffed that he's not in the headlines anymore with his trial. Like, any headline is a good headline for Trump. And now that the protesters are taking over, there's probably some very guttural reaction to how dare they take the spotlight and headlines from me. So I think he's going to raise the temperature. And I think that, you know, the protesters are probably going to push back against that. And that could have some, with the mercury rising, that might lead to some very ugly outcomes.
Right. And I think that the those folks from White House might be wise to listen to what President Trump was saying at his speech Wednesday night in Michigan, which was vile, I thought. I encourage listeners to look at the Washington Post. There's an interview with Hallie Sofer, if I'm saying her name correctly, CEO of the Jewish Democratic Council of America. She says, Republicans politicizing Israel and trying to use it as a wedge issue is nothing new. For decades, about three quarters of Jewish voters have supported Democrats because Democrats align with their values on every issue, including Israel. Republicans looking at their approximately 25% of the Jewish vote over time will try anything to try to increase those numbers, recognizing how critical the Jewish vote can be in battleground states where elections will continue to be very close. And she said, you know, talks about them using their old playbook, and that she says, politicizing anti-Semitism, I don't think it will work because Donald Trump has accused three quarters of Jewish voters of being disloyal. That in and of itself, by the way, is anti-Semitic claim.
Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Friday, May 3rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are posted online at WAMC.org. They're available via podcast or in the WAMC app. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.